Are humans becoming enslaved by their own technology? How is the technosphere different from the biosphere? Can technology solve the ecological crisis? How do religion, morality, and political movements work to undermine our autonomy as human beings? What was the true motivation behind Ted Kaczynski's actions as the Unabomber? Does the war of words between U.S. governing authorities and their Russian counterparts signal that a nuclear war between the major powers is on the horizon? On this week's Global Research News Hour, Russian-American author and analyst Dmitry Orlov returns, having recently written a new book with a unique take on how our technologies are not only wrecking the planet, but taking control of society and individuals, and how our species may be able to emancipate itself before it's too late. We'll also get his thoughts about whether the diplomatic rift between Russia and the U.S. could lead to global war. On this week's program, Dmitry Orlov on Shrinking the Technosphere, U.S. Warmongering Toward Russia. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 21st, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory, on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available for the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Europe is dependent on financial and energy resources of Moscow, according to a report by the Washington Center for Strategic and International Studies. On October 13, in Washington, a study was published, The Kremlin's Playbook, Understanding the Russian Influence in Eastern and Central Europe, which, on the example of five countries, Latvia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Slovakia, and Serbia, explains the mechanisms of the workings of the Kremlin with the economies of European states. According to analysts, the work of Russia in Latvia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Slovakia, and Serbia is aimed at consolidating around itself the sympathetic politicians, dominance on energy markets, and providing the most favorable economic partnerships. In some countries, Russian influence has reached such proportions that it jeopardized their pro-Western orientation and Euro-Atlantic stability as such, reads the report. That comes from the article, The Kremlin's Playbook, Washington Views Russia-EU Cooperation a Threat to U.S. National Security. Posted October 20th, originally appearing at Fort Rus. On Tuesday, the Foreign Ministry of Ecuador confirmed WikiLeaks' charge that Ecuador itself had ordered the severing of Assange's internet connection under pressure from the U.S. government. In a statement, the ministry said that WikiLeaks had, quote, published a wealth of documents impacting on the U.S. election campaign, unquote, adding that the government of Ecuador, quote, respects the principle of non-intervention in the internal affairs of other states, unquote, and, quote, does not interfere in external electoral processes, unquote. On that grounds, the statement claimed, the Ecuadorian government decided to, quote, restrict access, unquote, to the communications network at its London embassy. This statement from the bourgeois government of Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa is a study in hypocrisy and cowardice. By abetting the U.S. government's suppression of WikiLeaks, Quito has intervened in the U.S. elections on the side of the ruling establishment and against the rights of the American people. That comes from the article, Washington Moves to Silence WikiLeaks, by Bill Van Auken, posted October 19th, originally appearing at World Socialist website. The heroin epidemic is big enough now for congressional hearings to be called. Basic questions can be asked like, 1. How did Afghan opium spread from 7,600 hectares to 224,000 hectares? Two, why did U.S. heroin deaths shoot up from 1,779 in 2001 to 10,574 in 2014? Three, how did the Taliban eradicate Afghan opium from 93,000 hectares in 1999 to 7,600 hectares in 2001? Four, why hasn't the current administration done likewise? And five, why did President Obama stop all U.S. opium eradication efforts in U.S.-occupied Afghanistan in 2009, effectively greenlighting the Afghan opium and heroin trade? I contacted all 535 U.S. Congress people and several hundred opposition candidates to find out Congress's take on this deadly epidemic. Seven incumbents responded, as did 33 opposition candidates. Answers varied from close the CIA to beef up the border with Mexico to decriminalize drugs to more treatment to eradicate Afghan opium crops. That comes from the article, U.S. Congress's Take on the Heroin Epidemic, 6,400 tons produced in U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, by William Edstrom, posted October 20th, originally appearing at Dissident Voice. The Iraqi army started a large operation to liberate Mosul from Islamic State jihadists. The intent of the U.S. is to let ISIS fighters, several thousand of them, flee to Deir ez-Zor and Raqqa in Syria. They are needed there to further destroy the Syrian state. We pointed out here that this move will create the Salafist principality the U.S. and its allies have striven to install in East Syria since 2012. The quote-unquote mistake of the U.S. bombing of Syrian army positions in Deir ez-Zor was in support of that plan. That comes from the article, The U.S.-Turkey Escape Corridor Out of Mosul. ISIS-Daesh terrorists transferred from Iraq into Syria to fight Syrian, Russian, and Iranian forces. By Moon of Alabama, posted October 19th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Technology. It is an inescapable feature of humankind's liberation and at the same time at the heart of the ecological devastation threatening the habitability of this planet. One thinker who has devoted extensive time and energy to addressing the dilemmas associated with technologies and modern society is Dmitry Orlov. He recently authored the book Shrinking the Technosphere, Getting a Grip on the Technologies That Limit Our Autonomy, Self-Sufficiency, and Freedom. Dmitry Orlov is a Russian-American engineer and a sought-after political analyst. He's written hundreds of articles and made numerous media appearances. He's the author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Experience and American Prospects, as well as the Five Stages of Collapse Survivors Toolkit. In his most recent publication, Orlov coins the term technosphere in reference to an artificial domain analogous to the biosphere. It dates back about 2.5 million years when an early ancestor of modern humans, Homo habilis, started fashioning the first tools by sharpening rocks. Later innovations included the control of fire and the adoption of clothing. Over time, early humans evolved to become dependent on these technologies so that their descendants developed digestive tracts requiring cooked food, claws became useless fingernails requiring manufactured implements like knives, and so on. But in relatively recent history, technologies became so advanced and powerful that they eliminated the need of humans to adapt to their environments. They did, in fact, transform the environments in profound ways with the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, causing modern humans to inhabit a realm outside the natural world. In the following conversation, which was conducted in mid-October, Dmitry Orlov explains that the technosphere at this time went through a shocking, even terrifying, metamorphosis.
The technosphere which is the entire artificial realm we have created with all of the machinery, all of these different life support systems, has developed a sentience of its own. It has developed its own agenda, which is very different from our human agenda. It really doesn't necessarily have our interests in mind at all. It uses us as slaves and servants, especially the technologists and the engineers, and everybody else is, it pretty much tries to replace with robots. And that's the state that we're in, where basically the technosphere is in runaway mode. It is destroying the biosphere. If it destroys the biosphere, it destroys us with it, because we're really part of the biosphere. We depend on it for air, water, food, etc. And it is something that we need to stop in order to avoid going extinct.
A lot of our listeners may be familiar with the concept of Gaia, which is this idea that our planet is actually like this from James Lovelock, that it's more than just a whole bunch of or a sequence of different living organisms that are interacting with each other, that it is in total it is an organism in its own right. And it sounds like when you talk about the technosphere, it sounds like, you know, the same thing that you were talking, as you say, about a certain kind of a sentience. But I guess by analogy, this would be more like a kind of a parasitic relationship to Gaia, as it were.
That's right. It is a parasitic entity that exists on top of Gaia and undermines it. The technosphere, unlike Gaia, is unable to maintain a planet-wide homeostatic equilibrium. In fact, it's busy overheating the planet, driving a wave of extinction. It pollutes the environment in all sorts of ways that destroy life. It cannot exist in balance with natural resources. In fact, you know, it has some sort of intelligence to it, but it also has a certain gigantic blind spot, which is it cannot see natural limits until it hits them. And when it does hit them, it has another blind spot, which is it sees natural resource limits as financial problems. So if oil prices are too high and there's a shortage of oil, the solution is to throw money at the problem. And of course, that only works for a very short period of time and results in economic failure. But those are the things that basically will cause the technosphere to fail. The question is, are we going to fail with it? Well, the answer to that depends on how dependent we are on the technosphere, whether we basically swallow the entire, you know, accept the entire package, or if we make conscious decisions to select the technologies that help us become autonomous and independent instead of the ones that enslave us and make us dependent.
So we're talking about something that shapes our whole way of looking at the world. And if we can't get out of that psychology, we're just going to be compounding the problem.
Well, yes, that's right. And I run into people all the time, very well-meaning people who concentrate on something. They concentrate on renewable energy. They think that if they solve their one problem that they see as a major impediment, that if they provide clean renewable energy, then all the other problems go away. But of course, they will not go away. Some problems will be eased while other problems will be exacerbated. And what these people have as their blind spot is a misplaced sense of agency. They think that humans are in control. They think that we humans can make decisions on behalf of the technosphere that will be beneficial to us, whereas nothing could be further from the truth. We're basically being manipulated by an entity that is in control, that has its own agenda, that doesn't really like living things at all. It prefers chemistry and physics to biology. Its favorite thing to do with living things is exterminate them. It likes to replace living things with machines. Failing that, it tries to get living things to work like machines. So, for instance, all of the livestock and breeding experiments and all of the hybridization that goes into making useful or edible plants is all in the direction of treating nature as a machine. And we're part of that. So what the technosphere tries to do is to get us to exhibit various robotic machine-like behaviors. We are trained to do that. Most of the educational system is based on the idea of rule following and obedience. In the process, we lose all sense of free will and initiative and free agency. We just become slaves to the technosphere. And of course, part of the package is the technosphere has developed various ways to convince us that we're free so that we don't rebel.
And just, you know, probing that a little bit more, I mean, like, say, the life sciences has been reduced to genetics, you know, the DNA molecule, that blueprint, and, you know, that's something that the technosphere can get its grip on, but that is, in some sense, a restriction of our experience of the natural world, if you're just reducing it down to something that you can kind of pin down and manipulate. Something you hear all the time from activists, it's all the, if we just took all this money and all this that's being directed toward, you know, war or whatever, and directed it toward, you know, solving the climate crisis with the renewable technology or what have you. And you make the point in the book that the technosphere loves money or monetary systems. Could you maybe help us understand what is it about our system of currency, or that particular system of exchange, that is so, you know, that allows the technosphere, that really seems to feed the technosphere, if that's the way to put it?
Oh, well, you know, the technosphere is basically a machine-like entity. It uses machine-like intelligence and reasoning based on numbers and logic. And it establishes rules for us to follow based on numbers and logic. In terms of controlling human behavior, money is very useful because it allows everything to be quantified. For the technosphere, if something cannot be assigned a monetary value, then it is by definition worthless. So by default, everything, including various wild animals, have a monetary value, even if they're just, you know, basically being poached and traded on the black market. That's still a monetary value. And so that is really what the technosphere tries to do. You cannot really battle it by spending money because that's its native medium. In terms of figuring out ways of counteracting intractable problems like natural resource depletion, money allows it to distort the economy, really, to assign false value to things like tar sands, for instance. In the long run, exploitation of low-grade resources like tar sands, like hydrofracturing, what they're doing in the Dakotas now and in Texas, you know, those are not things that can be profitably pursued because the net energy from that sort of endeavor is too low. But it can be distorted over time using money. So the end game of the technosphere is the destruction of the economic system by misallocation of capital.
I think that one of the aspects of this book that's so provocative and was kind of difficult for me to process, to tell you the truth, is this idea that the technosphere really alters our way of looking at, like, at a very, what we would think is a very basic level, of the way we think of ourselves, the way we think of our you know, spiritual connections, that. Things, even something like not like organized religion and even moral codes are, as we see it today, are artifacts, are manifestations of the technosphere. And that's difficult for people to, at least, you know, for me to kind of process, because we look at some of our most intimate ways of, you know, our connection with our creator or you know, or what have you, to think that in some sense, or you know, sense of human rights, what have you, to think that that is actually, in some sense, a manifestation of this technological, technospheric entity.
Well, yes. Well, the technosphere has become extremely adept. It's not just, you know, technology in the conventional sense. It's also social and political technology that makes up the technosphere. And a lot of that has to do with manipulating human culture. Religion is really part of culture. And what the technosphere exploits is basically a human weakness. You know, we're not very far evolved from having monkey brains. You know, we're sort of working with monkey brain 2.0. And religion is part of that. What religion really is, basically a sincere expression of ignorance. That's religion at its best. That in spite of not really knowing what's going on, we're somehow going to make sense of the world to make ourselves and each other feel better. You know, we want to think that we exist for a reason, even if that reason doesn't exist, and we can't prove that it exists. Our faculties, as far as actually determining the truth, are very limited. But what we really want is a story. So if, say, a four-year-old starts asking you the question, why, right? Saying, I don't know, doesn't really satisfy, because you're supposed to make up a story. You're supposed to make up a story. And that's what really religion is. We want a story about, you know, stone tablets being handed down. And we want stories about parting of the Red Sea. We want drama. You know, we want great stories. And that's what really religion is. So those stories can be used to manipulate our consciousness in all sorts of ways. The point is that to the technosphere, morality is a tool. It can make us behave in moral ways. It can kill us. It can ignore our immorality. It can encourage us to behave in immoral ways. All of those are just tools in its toolkit. There's nothing special about any of them.
Hmm. Could you talk about the way we look at, say, the different movements that have come up over the ages, that on the one hand they seem very progressive, and feminist movements or you know, different LGBTQ rights or what have you, but in some sense, they do play to the advantage of the technosphere insofar as they undermine local social collectives. Is that something you can? Because that's one of the things that was that can be a little bit difficult to process.
Well, the thing that the technosphere finds incredibly difficult to deal with, to oppose, is the human clan. It's a type of organization where people deal with each other face to face. They don't really have much recourse to money. They all stand up for each other and act as a group. They interact with the outside world as a group, as representatives of a group, rather than as individuals. It's either impossible or very difficult for outsiders to penetrate the clan. You know, it's separatist. The relationships within the clan are determined by various types of, you know, traditional gender roles, so that marriage, for instance, exists for the sake of past and future generations. It does not exist for the sake of the individuals entering into the marriage. The function of a family is to perpetuate the clan. It's not to perpetuate those two particular individuals that enter into their marriage. And of course, all kinds of quote-unquote deviant modes of behavior, you know, LGBT, et cetera, are not really encouraged. There's no pride in being gay, because if you're gay, you're not going to successfully perpetuate the clan by reproducing, are you? So those people tend to be kind of relegated to the margins. Those are very normal human things. They have been normal human things for a very long time, and deviations from this norm have only become possible pretty much since industrialization on a large scale. Before that, you know, maybe the aristocracy could be, you know, strange and behave in various strange and libertine ways. But libertine behavior didn't really spread to the masses until rather recently. And this development is going to be fairly short-lived, in my opinion. It's just not going to continue for very long because it's really contrary to the requirements of survival in nature. And so we may like all of these values, like women having careers and being independent of men, but we have to understand that, you know, these things are supported by various types of technosphere services. So women are defended by the police. But if the police goes away and men battle for survival, then women will once again become dependent on men for defense. And we have to understand that the police and various types of social organizations of that sort are at this point pretty much just projections of the technosphere, and they're pursuing an agenda that is very different from what our agenda should be.
So how does one grapple with something like, for example, the emancipation of slaves in the United States? Because, I mean, it almost sounds like certainly there was a morality that went along with it in recognizing the injustices, but I'm wondering now, because it's that emancipation came along at the same time as the technology enabled it to, so that maybe that particular evolution, it was no more a testament to an evolved morality than the transition away from the horse and buggy to mechanized vehicles.
Well, look, everything that's happened to African Americans since emancipation indicates the utter hypocrisy of the idea that, you know, the Civil War had anything to do with ending slavery. There are now more African American slaves in the United States now working in jails as slave labor on various types of work gangs and in various types of service and manufacturing, making a profit for somebody, than there were slaves in the South prior to the Civil War. So slavery has not really gone away. It has just basically been renamed. The reason that the whole moral narrative existed is to motivate people, because telling them that, well, we're going to have this incredibly horrible war because the North has the industrial capacity to fight a modern industrial war now and the South doesn't. And we're going to do that to pry the South away from England, away from being, an agrarian adjunct to the British Empire, in order to absorb it into the United States in economic terms, disrupt its trade, et cetera, destroy it economically, and liberate this black labor that was farm labor before, and then ship them north so that they can work in factories, that this is all an industrial project. And people are just a raw material for it. Okay, that story doesn't really sell. It has to be some, again, we humans like stories with our monkey brain 2.0. And we like to be told stories that make us feel noble and proud and good about ourselves. And so that was the story that, you know, we're ending slavery. But, you know, all of the mistreatment that the African Americans have suffered and are continuing to suffer indicate that that's not really it.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. I know that you pointed to a couple of, you even called it in the book, kindred spirits. One being Jacques Ellul, and the other being none other than Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. And I was wondering if you could maybe just you talk about what you drew from. Maybe we should focus on, for example, maybe on the Ted Kaczynski case in particular, because I found it very, you did evoke the fact that this was more than just a paranoid schizophrenic who you maybe just got a little bit deluded. I mean, you do seem to you express real empathy for where he was coming from. So I wonder
well,
if
you... yeah. Well, let's start with the nude, because they both sort of went in the same direction. Jacques Ellul, you know, his writing is many decades old, but he was the first to actually get an inkling of the fact that there is now this machine-like intelligence, a sentient entity that is running things, that humans are no longer in control. That was his, you know, key insight that, you know, we humans have relegated our control, our agency to what he called la technique or le technique. And he overloaded these terms a lot, which makes his writing a little bit opaque, especially translated into English. You know, quite impenetrable for some people. But and the other major failing he has was that, you know, he just couldn't connect that to the choice, to individual choice. But he realized that basically humans were no longer in charge. And that was his major breakthrough. And Ted Kaczynski, first of all, he was subjected to this MKUltra experiment while he was an undergrad at Harvard, which was a U.S. government experiment where people were, subjects were subjected to experimental drugs, hallucinogenics, while having their psyche probed and manipulated. The whole idea was to basically make people into robots that could be programmed to do various jobs for the government. That was the pretty much the thrust of it. So he had basically a revelation, if I could call it that. He suddenly glimpsed one of the worst aspects of the technosphere, you know, the part that compels it to treat people like robots and fashion them into robots. So after that, he was pretty much on a mission to avoid the technosphere. You know, he taught for a while at Berkeley, but that was just to save up money to put together his cabin in the woods in Montana. And then he lived happily in that cabin, you know, foraging for wild foods, et cetera. But then the Forest Service came in as another projection of the technosphere and started building in roads and encroaching on his habitat. And that's when he decided to basically start fighting back. That's when he became this kind of, you know, boutique terrorist who sent little letter bombs to people. You know, as far as terrorism goes, you know, if you compare him to somebody like Barack Obama, who's been, you know, killing people all over the place, you know, funerals, wedding parties, whatever, using predator drones, he wasn't much of a terrorist. You know, he blew up a few people here and there, and that was only to send a message. And obviously that's, you know, a flawed technique. But in his case, it was somewhat successful because he's still being remembered. His manifesto is being read in university courses, you know, in various countries, which is actually, you know, people should read it because it's very well written. And I quote quite a bit from it. But he was basically, you know, the first person who understood who the enemy is or what the enemy is. And that's why I made use of his work.
I'd like to ask you to share some, I don't know, tips as to how we can confront this beast without becoming useful idiots that just, you know, strengthens it. I mean, what are the things that we need to watch out for? Maybe a checklist, if you will.
Well, that's too much detail to go into, but there's an entire chapter in the book on that called Harm-Benefit Analysis. And it presents a method that basically allows one to rank various technologies in terms of their harm and their benefit. Basically, if you choose technologies that allow you to gain a greater measure of autonomy and self-sufficiency and freedom, and reject those that enslave you and link you to the technosphere and force you to give up control, then over time, not only will you achieve these stated goals, but you will also shrink the technosphere. That is why the title of the book is what it is. It's a method for shrinking the technosphere. And none of these things are particularly radical to start with. You know, it becomes, develops a radical edge as you move further and further away from the technosphere. But to start with, these are very reasoned choices. This is nothing extremist at all. This is very reasoned, very moderate, basically you figure out where you are working for your own benefit as opposed to the benefit of the technosphere, and you behave accordingly. The important thing is that, you know, people can talk about all sorts of things and do absolutely nothing about them. And that is the typical pattern. You know, people read lots of books about things that they can't do anything about. This book is about things that you can do something about. This can inform the decisions that you're making in your everyday life. Anything that you either buy or refurbish or make yourself can be informed by this metric that I've developed, the harm benefit analysis metric. Every type of technology is to some extent harmful, except one type that I'll say a few words about, because it uses up natural resources and it takes up energy and time. So you lose time, which is, you know, to some extent harmful. And most types of technology produce some kind of a benefit. Question is, to whom? Is that benefit to you, or is that benefit to some transnational corporation, that has convinced you to spend your income and your time to help it dispose of a waste product such as gasoline, which is industrially not very useful. It's a small engine fuel. So sticking you in a car and making you drive around every day is a really good way to get rid of gasoline at a profit. If you evaluate things on that basis, then you get a lot closer to what you want, what you specifically want. But there's another type of technology, which is called nature-like technology, which is really not that different from what exists in nature. So a good example is spiders make webs, and we make various types of webbing, you know, nets, basket weaving, etc. And so if we make these things out of natural materials, we're not departing that far from nature. We're not really harming nature by doing these things, per se, unless we use them to do things like overhunt or overfish. But if we do things that are more or less in balance with nature, using nature-like technologies, then we are basically producing zero harm. And that, I think, is the ultimate goal.
As I understand, well, what you write in the book, that term nature-like technology, was that not influenced by none other than Vladimir Putin?
Yeah, he seems to have coined the term and presented it at a major speech in front of the UN National Assembly. He said that basically technology, the technosphere, and he used those very terms, the technosphere has become out of balance with the biosphere, has to be brought back into balance with it by the use, the introduction of nature-like technologies. He used those very terms. And that's one of the things that prompted me to start thinking about it. You know, if he's thinking about it, why don't I think about it too?
Mm. Now, I wanted to, just to kind of close this, this discussion about your book, because it is certainly a real eye opener, and speaking as somebody who's been, I've done interviews on your term human extinction and the futility of, or the co-option of activist groups. But this book was it's very easy to read technically, but it can be very challenging to wrap your mind around some of the concepts that you evoke here. But at the end of the day, you are somewhat even though this is going to be very challenging for vast numbers of human beings, you are confident that there is a note of optimism here about people, if they can just overcome some of the psychology and that tendency to just sort of, you know, shrink in the face of all of these things and just get to work, you know, get busy surviving by rejecting, like consciously rejecting this technosphere and recovering that autonomy that is going to be necessary for our survival when that technosphere eventually fails us.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that sounds like a wonderful endorsement. And, you know, the only thing I'd like to add is, you know, there's lots of books that basically allow us to endlessly moan about things we can't do anything about, be it politics, be it, you know, environmental problems, political problems, whatever else. So a lot of books allow us to immerse ourselves in a world that we cannot do anything about. This book is very different. This book basically teaches you an approach, which is very generic. You make your own decisions. It doesn't tell you what to do, but it teaches you an approach to take control, to actually make changes, make decisions, and make changes.
Again, the book is Shrinking the Technosphere, Getting a Grip on the Technologies That Limit Our Autonomy, Self-Sufficiency, and Freedom by New Society Publishers. So I definitely encourage people to pick it up. It's coming out in November. While I've got you on the line, Dimitri, I can't resist but get your take on some of the recent events that have been, I'm going to say overtaking and overwhelm us when we look at the what appears to be a deterioration of relations between the United States and Russia over Syria, predominantly. But I mean, we've seen a buildup from this for some time now. I guess you could probably trace it back to the war on Yugoslavia back in the late 1990s. But we seem to be seeing an acceleration as we've moved, like, you know, Syria and Ukraine, and now recently with this terse war of words, U.S. generals, making a lot of bombastic rhetoric, and of course Samantha Powers at the UN, and I think a lot of people are concerned that World War III is just around the corner. You seem to be fairly confident that there's not going to be a nuclear exchange, at least not triggered deliberately.
Yes, I don't believe that that's going to be the case. This is really a culmination of an American strategy that has, been failing for a long time. And we're now at a point where its failure can no longer be disguised as anything but a complete and total fiasco in international foreign policy. So to start with Yugoslavia, you know, that was the case where NATO, led by the United States, bombed a European country, scattered depleted uranium munitions dust all over the place, so that now people in Serbia are dying of cancer from it, all because of supposed atrocities committed by Serbs in an old region of Serbia called Kosovo, which had a rather large Albanian minority. Now, and in the process, Slobodan Milosevic was cast as a dictator and a butcher and somebody who had to be deposed. So what happened was Kosovo was torn away from Serbia and turned into a large military base by NATO and a major European drugs, illegal drugs, transshipment point. Slobodan Milosevic died in detention in The Hague and was subsequently, recently exonerated. And all of the allegations of atrocities in Kosovo eventually turned out to be false. So most people in the U.S. and the West don't realize that this, but most people in Russia know this very well, that basically the entire campaign against Serbia was based on nothing more than lies. So with regard to the Ukraine, there was a long-term strategy pursued by the United States to politically destabilize Ukraine. There was not one, but two color revolutions there. The last one in February 2014. And the entire thrust of that was to tear the Ukraine away from Russia. The Ukraine and Russia were linked historically. It's basically the same people in the same country. To tear the Ukraine away from Russia and to turn it into a sort of anti-Russia. This was done by cultivating a certain cadre of rabid Ukrainian nationalist Nazi sympathizers who were cultivated in Canada and in the United States and shipped into the Ukraine to stir things up. And of course, the other objective was to grab Crimea away from Russia, to eject the Russian Black Sea Fleet from there, where it has been based for hundreds of years, and to build it into a NATO base that would then undermine Russia's security from right under Russia's underbelly, right next to its territory. So all of these plans have completely failed. The Ukraine is now a defunct state. It's no longer it no longer has its territorial integrity. Crimea, of course, just voted to go back to Russia in accordance with international law, held a referendum. And so that's a complete failure. Now, as far as Syria, the United States and its Western accomplices have been trying to overthrow the government of Bashar al-Assad for about 5 years now, using a technique called terrorism by proxy. That's where you arm terrorists and then tell them to go and overthrow a government, start a civil war. It's been a terrible, bloody civil war, and at some point, Russia intervened about a year ago and successfully fought back the terrorists that the Americans have been quote-unquote fighting, but really, you know, they were arming them and training them and trading with them. And so now the terrorists are on the run. The government is recapturing Aleppo. And the last thing that happened is, you know, basically the Americans had to concede that they lost and that they don't have any political options. There's no pressure they can exert on Russia, and they have no military options because the Russian military at this point is not something that can be trifled with. Just to give you a specific example, the Americans can no longer use their aircraft carriers anywhere in the vicinity of the Russian or the Iranian or the Chinese military because there are enough weapon systems of different kinds to blow American aircraft carriers out of the water, that they don't even risk that anymore. That's just one example. But basically, the Americans have no cards to play, and the result is that they've gone insane. So they're off the reservation, they're ranting. So if you listen to somebody like Samantha Power at the UN, you know, she's just some insane harpy, you know, spitting venom. You know, this is not to be taken seriously. You know, When you listen to Hillary Clinton, who's, you know, some kind of a mental patient at this point, you know, spewing vitriol in the general direction of Russia, she doesn't know what she's talking about. Same thing with these Pentagon generals. They don't have a plan. They don't have a strategy. There's there's no winning strategy they can pursue. So all they do is just vent their aggression at the television camera. And I don't think there's going to be a war. Of course, there can always be a, you know, there's no accounting for extreme stupidity. So there can always be an accident that leads to an escalation that might even theoretically lead to a nuclear exchange. But I'm optimistic because the people in charge of, you know, military strategy, you know, are not suicidal. They're not insane. They tend to be relatively level-headed, mid-rank people, and they do not propose policies that are suicidal. And any attack on Russia would be pretty much suicide at this point.
When it comes to something like, well, like all the language that you're hearing from, well, currently in this so-called this presidential election, all the angry language directed toward Putin. I mean, how are the Russian people reacting to all of that? Do they see it as just the hollow, you know, rantings that you've just been, you know, describing? Is it just, you know, do they read anything significant into it that would cause them to mobilize in any way on the ground?
Well, there's a groundswell of patriotism in Russia that's been happening for quite a while now, because Russia has been so incredibly resurgent in every sphere, politically, culturally, economically, on the world stage. And it's, you know, it's the country that everybody is now looking at, because it's the one that's forging its own path rather successfully and impressively. So, you know, the Russians definitely feel good about themselves. As far as their feelings about the United States, well, a lot of people in Russia, right before and after the fall of the Soviet Union, the collapse, and during the 90s, a lot of people idolized the West and the United States, and a lot of people emigrated during that time to the United States. A lot of them have gone back since then. But now, because everything that the Americans say against Russia is adequately explored on mass media in Russia, people are very well informed about what's going on. And their attitude towards the United States and the West in general, which they see as American puppets, is one of profound disgust. Just absolutely seething, cold disgust.
Several months ago, you and I believe it was the Saker and a number of other Russian American individuals had penned a letter to the American people, the warning about the direction that the U.S. was headed. Do you want to maybe just describe what was the intent behind that letter in terms of this this constant rush, the enmity that's grown between the U.S. and Russia?
Oh, it was basically to frighten the hell out of the idiots who think that there's something to be gained by this sort of pseudo march to war, because accidents do happen. Just to explain to them that basically what they're going for is national suicide. I mean, how many nukes do you think it would take to just basically completely knock the U.S. economy out, just out cold, where it can't be put back together again? And you're looking at a country that's basically hemorrhaging billions of dollars a month of debt, where pension funds are all insolvent, where the infrastructure is falling apart, where the political system is on the verge of civil war, you know, that is completely dependent on imports from all over the world that are paid for by money that's printed into existence. How many nuclear explosions does it take to make a country like that just basically fold up? Not too many. So any kind of a nuclear exchange is the end of the United States. Whereas in Russia, you know, first of all, it's a gigantic country. Secondly, it is very well defended. Russians have developed their anti-ballistic systems and their air defense systems to a very high level. They've never stopped working on it. So now they have very good systems. They can defend most of Moscow quite well, and they can probably survive a few nukes. So a limited nuclear exchange would, I think, completely eliminate the United States and would give the Russians, you know, a really, really hard time.
Plus, you have the whole situation where Russia and China are restoring a relationship with each other that had been kind of on the fritz since the Khrushchev era.
Well, that is the gigantic, glaring geopolitical defeat for the United States, is that basically China, Russia, to a lesser extent India, and even Pakistan and Iran are now acting as a unit. Russia and China specifically acting as a unit. China really wants to treat Russia as an ally. They're integrating their economies to a very large extent. They have very ambitious programs to extend this cooperation. Putin was just in Goa signing deals with India, you know, many billions of dollars worth of projects and, you know, various stages of development. And so basically the U.S. And the West in general is being cut out of that. You know, they will no longer have influence in that. So are they going to resort to some, you know, panicked military effort in that direction, considering that, you know, they haven't won, they couldn't win in Korea or in Vietnam. You know, they blew up Iraq, but they couldn't. Right now they're back there fighting because, you know, it's just, they never won, really. They couldn't win in Syria. They couldn't win in, you know, in the Ukraine. Of course, Kosovo is a great prize. You know, before that, they won and, you know, they took over the little island of Grenada. Not too many victories, you know. So this is not the U.S. and NATO in general. They have a huge, very expensive military, but the question is, why can't it fight?
I guess it's fairly comforting to know that for all of the that Shakespearean saying, that poor player on the stage full of sound and fury signifying nothing is essentially what I think I'm hearing from you in terms of what we're hearing from American politicians and generals. So,
well, it signifies that the Americans have finally lost their minds. that's definitely something it signifies. And you know, the Russians, well, if they have to provide, you know, free psychiatric treatment, that's what they'll do.
Okay. Well, Dmitry Orlov, I think we'll probably close it right about here, but I want to thank you very much. You've been very patient with us for the course of the last hour, and I want to remind our listeners again that you are the author of Shrinking the Technosphere, Getting a Grip on the Technologies That Limit Our Autonomy, Self-Sufficiency, and Freedom from New Society Publishers. It will be released officially next month in November. Listeners should check out the blog cluborlov.com, where he puts up an essay every Tuesday. Dmitry, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Michael. Been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.